You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Radio MMT respectfully acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land from which we are broadcasting, the Wurundjeri people, and we are broadcasting to the Kulin nations. Our focus is economics, that is, how stuff is produced and distributed. We recognise that for many tens of thousands of years, First Nations peoples' connection to country successfully embodied the world's oldest continuous economy, which was catastrophically disrupted by genocide and displacement. We acknowledge that we have much to learn to reshape our current extractive and exploitive system to achieve sustainable prosperity for everyone.
Radio MMT. Economics for the rest of us with Anne
and Kev.
Radio MMT.
Looking at the world through the lens of modern monetary theory.
Radio MMT. Macroeconomics for a well-being economy.
Macroeconomics? Like, isn't that incredibly boring?
No, Kevin, it's incredibly interesting. It's all about who gets what and why.
Who gets what and why? Okay, I'm in.
Radio MMT at gmail.com.
Incredibly interesting macroeconomics for the rest of us. Welcome to Radio MMT. This week you're here with Kevin and Katie. How are you, Katie?
I'm excellent, Kevin. I always have an additional spring in my step when I know I'm going to round off the day having a chat with one of my brilliant, wonderful colleagues.
And hello to our listener. Hello, listeners. How are you doing? We're going to have a bit of a loose show this week. There were some things that got me thinking about the last show that we did. We had Bill Mitchell on. I call him a fan of Marx. That's incorrect. He's a student of Marx, and he believes that Marx is the best economist at understanding capitalism. And if you want to understand the machinations of capitalism, you need to study Marx. And I have no doubt that he's right. And one day I will read more Marx. But I haven't done that yet. But it did get me thinking, because he's also very peaceful, Bill. He says that if you have a violent revolution, it's probably going to leave its fingerprints of violence in the new system. It'll corrupt the new system. And if you want to change the way you're doing things, if you do it with violence, it's going to probably not start well and could continue down the same track.
Yes, start the way you want to continue. Yeah.
And we've seen this. However, I also then thought that if you do a bit of a deep dive into capitalism and you see how capitalism reacts to anything that threatens its model, you know, for instance, the 1917 revolution in Russia started, the USSR and communism, and this sent, you know, shivers up the USA and the capitalist system to the point where you see a reaction to capitalism in the US, particularly after World War II, that is just incredibly violent. And what you understand is that these capitalists aren't going to just hand it over. From my dying hand, you're going to have to pull this rifle. Who was that actor?
Good old Moses himself, Charlton Heston.
Charlton Heston, from my dying hand. It's like they are not going to let go of their profit-driven model without a fight. So how do you transition peacefully if the people that who you're trying to transition from are just going to shoot you en masse?
Well, I think the first thing to remember, like, this is where Bill and I might depart a bit. To me, capitalism is not so much an ideology as a practice. And it's quite happy to ride on the coattails of other ideologies that provide justification for the practice. So, I mean, going back 600 years to, the birth of liberalism, capitalists in the form of the landed gentry who had unearned income of all the peasants working on their land, were quite happy to see the power of the monarchy diminished and the power of Parliament increased, because Parliament in those days was basically the landed gentry.
Is this a kind of like, if you're going through your class structure, you're talking about, you've got nobility, but they regard themselves as almost divine, you know, kings come from providence. It was I'm thinking of that Monty Python sketch where they come across the people in the mud, and he says, "Step aside, I'm your king." And she says, "King," he says, "you're king." He says, "Well, my ancestors pulled the stone from the thing," and he goes, I don't care about some watery tart and pull on the thing. The nobility, they don't have to earn it. It's just who they are. We see that repeated in history time and time again. We've got our own nobility, the class that would call themselves the nobles now, who are just the mega rich, the uber rich.
Yeah, the logic is totally circular. So, I mean, if you're an aristocrat, you want to say, well, I have my position by virtue of the fact that God gave me my position because God's all powerful. And if he didn't want me to have this position, I wouldn't have it.
Yeah.
So that's totally circular. The modern equivalent is the idea of meritocracy. The foundational belief is that if you work hard and you're diligent and you're brilliant and insightful, then you are going to become wealthy. So the mere fact that you're wealthy proves that you are brilliant and have earned everything you have.
Yeah. The allocation of status coincidentally often equals your bank account, And how I want to sort of frame this discussion today, we're basically talking about capitalism, where it's going, how it's going to end up where it's going, and what the options are. And I don't think anybody can really argue this anymore. The discussions that capitalism is overshooting its planetary boundaries. And you have to remember that every amount of profit that was made anywhere comes from a natural resource. If you turn a dollar and you make a buck, it's because you've taken something from your world and turned it into something that you can make profit from. It might be people, it might be rocks, it might be, it doesn't matter what it is, wood, it could be water. You take something from the earth and you turn it into a product which you can make profit from. And that's okay so long as there's enough of it to go around. But I think it's irrefutable now that we are exceeding our planetary boundaries, and that if we continue doing the same thing, much like whales heading to the shallows, we're going to beach ourselves, and this is not going to end well. It's kind of like, and we talk about this a lot, this cognitive disconnect. We can see what's happening. It's all around us now. They said 20, 30 years ago that we'd be having extreme weather events, that temperatures would be rising, that we'd be having heat waves, that the cyclones would be getting stronger. They said also maybe further apart, that we'd see that levels in the sea rising. All these things are happening on cue, in fact, ahead of schedule. We've been told 1.5 degrees maximum. Make that 2. Oh, maybe we can stretch it to 2. But there comes a point where you can't stretch it anymore. So let's have a discussion about not, you know, if this is going to happen. Let's have a discussion about what happens with this model. Like, do we keep on doing this, or how do we get out of this?
Well, the power of denial is very, very strong. And you also have, like, another one of these delusional truisms, which is that in the past people have made dire predictions of calamity. Like, the one that people always point to is the 1971 Limits to Growth report that was put out by Donella Meadows and several other people. And in principle, it was perfectly correct in identifying the mechanisms. It was just off on the timetable. But people won't to say that we have always had these dire predictions of imminent collapse, and we've always got through it one way or another, usually by technical innovation. So just relying on that track record, we can say, well, whatever is coming, we can get over it with technological innovation and sufficient, you know, ingenuity and entrepreneurship.
We'll figure it out.
Yeah.
So the problem that I have with that argument, and this seems to run contrary to human nature, is that if there's a perceived threat, we're often a very cautious species. I mean, everybody's taking out insurance. Everybody's got insurance on their car, their home, all sorts of stuff. And it's insurance that they'll hopefully never need to use and would prefer not to use. Mm. But people take it out because it's a sensible thing to do. And yet when we see the calamity that is staring us in the face, you would have thought that even if there was a kind of like, okay, we'll figure it out, you could say, well, we might not be able to figure it out. We might need more time. You would think that a rational human being seeing that the dangers have been very clearly presented, would be taking preventative action, at least trying to delay the catastrophe by slowing things down or doing things to stop the inevitable coming at a rate of pace that might cause difficulty, death. And what we're talking about here is temperatures rising, sea levels rising, freshwater catchment areas being corrupted with salt water, crops failing, we're talking about mass extinction of many species, including ourselves. Time frame could be decades, it could be a century or two, but that seems to be the obvious conclusion when you have a look at what's happening. But the idea that we should be cautious and that we should take out some insurance to prevent these terrible things happening to us seems to have been overridden by the short-term capitalist mechanism, or that short-term gain seems to be blinding us to the long-term catastrophe.
Yeah, I mean, part of the ideology that we're currently getting towards the end of at the moment, which is called neoliberalism, it kicked off in the 1970s when there was the opportunity for people who were not happy with the post-war arrangement of broadly distributed wealth and reasonable equality, because you can't make a buck in that. Like, they took advantage of the 1970s oil crisis and the concurrent inflation and economic stagnation to say, well, we actually have the recipe for how to do things, for how to make things balance. And we've been mucking it up with all this government intervention since the war. You know, Friedrich Hayek was right. There is a wonderful self-equilibrating mechanism in the marketplace that makes a much, much wiser decision than any single expert or body of experts could ever make.
Now, that's the sell, right?
Yeah.
I'm skeptical of that sell. I reckon they knew that was a load of shit.
Oh, I totally agree.
I mean, if they believed that and they were selling it, I'd have a little more faith in it. But, you know, you're talking about the Mont Pelerin Society, which formed in 1947, yeah. And this is just a couple of years after the Bretton Woods program was worked out in the US. So the Bretton Woods program is a Keynesian approach to your economy, which asks for a lot more government involvement. And the Mont Pelerin Society are full-on private marketeers and profit-driven, and they don't want government interfering with their profit-driven model. And I think, to me, it seems like when they saw what was happening with the Bretton Woods program and John Maynard Keynes becoming involved in economics, they formed a group and liked things the way they were before, when a few individuals could make a shit ton of money and everybody else is working for them. And they come up with this whole, you know, this whole economic theory of balancing markets, etc. But I reckon they knew the whole way through. This was just a profit-driven model that made a few people very rich.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are certain people in the think tanks who are true believers, because they just don't have a lot of imagination, and they will do whatever makes them money.
Tony Abbott is a
yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, there are people who if your income depends on you believing something utterly improbable, they will quite happily believe something utterly improbable.
Yeah, this is the thing, isn't it? You know, like this ability for the human mind to shut out what is bleedingly obvious for just short-term gain. I've actually had regular work for the first time in quite some time just over the last few months, and I've been earning regular money, and I've forgotten what it's like. And you become very smug and secure. You're sort of like, I'm used to sort of having to look around, and now I'm actually, I've got a bit of savings behind me and some consistent work. And there's a feeling that comes with that. There's this kind of like security, etc. And you tend to just go, right, everything's going fine. Don't worry about anything else. It kind of puts you in a fog, you know. And I think that's a large part of why we don't see what's obvious.
Yeah, this tendency to cling to comfortable ideas is a large part of what we're seeing now that neoliberalism is breaking down and is being replaced by something else. We have a whole lot of people who are living behind colour-bond fencing with their five-car households, and they are saying, well, look, we didn't have all these problems a few years ago before all these immigrants and all these weirdos with purple hair came in. So obviously what's changed is that, and that's what's destroying our way of life and our comfortable setup.
It makes me think, what's expected of human nature? What's the responsibility of us? And not just individually, but collectively. And so now we sort of get back into what is human nature. I mean, it seems pretty obvious to me that human beings are social creatures. You know, if we want to punish somebody, we put them into solitary confinement. Mm. We need people around us. So we're social creatures, and we operate best when we operate collectively. You know, if everybody had to build their own bit of road to get up the street, and they had to produce all their own food and be totally self-sufficient, it would be very inefficient. And so as a species, we work together. We have some people doing this and they work together, have some people doing that. And collectively, we can be quite clever, quite smart and quite efficient. Mm. So to me, that just seems like that's human nature. I don't think it's too far-fetched for people to understand that's human nature. So why do they turn that off? I'm confused with it. How can we be so blind to what is should be our intrinsic nature? If I'm talking that we operate socially, I'm talking, you could call that socialism. If we're talking about operating collectively in a community, we're talking about communism. These are the ways that we operate. Hmm. And yet that's become something which is a foreign and to be abhorred. It's like, that's a terrible idea. Don't do that.
Yeah.
Weird.
Yeah, there's a book that came out a year or two ago by a guy called Richard Seymour called Disaster Nationalism, which has basically traced this latest wave of right-wing resurgence around the world. And the general phenomena is that when people feel threatened, this sort of Keynesianism, for want of a better word, this interregnum between the end of the Second World War and the 1970s.
Lovely 30-year period, 45 to 75, or thereabouts. Yeah.
That was bookended by two distinct phenomena. The one was a whole bunch of people coming back from World War II and thinking, well, look, we just had a Great Depression. A
couple of World Wars.
We've defeated fascism. Like, prior to the war, there was high unemployment. During the war, there was full employment directed towards the task of bombing things and killing people and so on and so forth. Why can't we have a world where there is full employment, building things actually benefit people, and, you know, carry on the sort of collective planning that took place during the war, where we achieved remarkable things? And so that frame of mind held sway for a long time until we got to the oil crisis of 73, and suddenly people who had been used to cheap, abundant energy had to queue at the petrol station for their, you know, for hours on end all of a sudden, and thought, well, this sucks.
Yeah.
And they were suddenly open to unscrupulous people with daring new ideas.
I guess this is human nature, is that we erase bad memories from our minds. We deal with them by parking them somewhere where we don't have to think about them anymore. If you're affected by something which is bad, get away from it and go towards something which is good. So, you know, 30 years after World War II, we've forgotten about World War II. We've forgotten about the Depression. You know, and now we know that, you know, I've got a new Ford. I can't remember what, I had an XR, and it was a 66, no, it'd be sometime after that. Anyway, so you know what I mean. But, so there's a new car, there's a new thing. It's consumerism starts kicking in. And I guess this is kind of like where we see the options. So the world knows that it's heading for disaster if we continue to do the same things. I think that's pretty much across the board now. We're past the stage of having to explain that or prove it. We can head towards this situation, this difficult situation, collectively and cooperatively, working together And if we did that, we would be able to manage our resources in a way that could soften the blow and keep things within targets, so that people are fed and housed and looked after as much as they possibly could. That would be the best way to do it. So the best way to approach this climate disaster that is heading to it's already on us, but it's only going to get worse and worse. Would be like when there's bushfires overseas, Australia sends over firefighters and everybody helps out. We all pull in together. The worst way to do it would be for everybody to start thinking of themselves first and making sure that they're okay and taking everything they possibly can to shore up that they're not going to be harmed by this too much, and I don't care about anybody else, but just make sure that I'm okay. There's a bit of a combination of two, but I would say capitalism is very much in the latter category, especially when you look at the what's happening in the United States. You're seeing the obvious result of a way of thinking with the way the United States, America first, just attack everybody to make sure that your interests come first. That's the worst way to approach this situation, but that seems to be the dominant way that we're looking at the moment.
Yeah, you also see the remarkable adaptability of capitalism to skip from one ideology to the next without missing a beat. The ideology that came in the 70s, neoliberalism, said, well, look, we are all hostage to the whims of billionaires, because billionaires is where money comes from. Money grows on rich people, as Stephanie Colton says.
Yeah.
So, like, we have to be nice to the rich people, and because otherwise they'll go away. They'll go away to a country that where people are nicer to them.
And take all their money with them, and then we'll have no money.
And then we'll have no money, because, of course,
the rich people have the money.
You know, the $10 note in my pocket has Gina Reinhart's signature on it, not the Secretary of the Treasury. That has been a very convincing part of the narrative for unscrupulous people, among them politicians, who say, well, look, we would love to do the right thing. We would love to house everyone. We'd love to feed everyone. But unfortunately, that's impossible, because if we do so, we're going to upset the billionaires. We're not going to make a very business-friendly environment for them to operate.
They say we're going to run out of money. They say we haven't got the money to do that. And this is how we started Radio MMT at the beginning of the year, was explaining that money is an invention of government. It's a state instrument. It comes from the state. Now, if the state creates the money that an economy uses, that means that economy is entirely dependent on the state. If it gives it to people and they become rich, that doesn't mean that they made the money. That means they collected and they use the money and collect the money. Yeah. And if they collect too much money, they can buy too much influence. They can become too powerful, too influential. Just that very basic understanding of where does money come from.
Yeah. Oxfam, I think I might have mentioned this before, Oxfam used to have this marvellous slogan, every billionaire is a policy failure. I instead would rephrase it to say every billionaire is a policy outcome. You know, nobody becomes a billionaire without the government at least nodding to it, giving their agreement to it. You know,
the fact that the currency issuer could allow certain individuals to accumulate unreasonable amounts of their currency means that they're not regulating their economy properly.
Yeah, they're not directing credit appropriately to achieve the collective outcomes that we all want.
Hypothetically speaking, here's a discussion for the listener at home. What's the most a person should earn in a fiscal year? Is it 1 million, 5 million, 10 million? Like, what's the absolute maximum somebody should earn in a year?
I think the more appropriate question is to ask what's the least somebody should earn.
Yeah, true.
The wonderful John Kenneth Galbraith said, in the context of development economics, the way you develop an economy is by aiming policy towards the interests of what he called the modal citizen, which is to say the most common person in your society, the greatest percentage of your population. And if you do that, you can't go far wrong.
So I fully agree with that. I think if you want to measure the success of an economy, you don't measure the success of the richest people. You look at the conditions of the poorest people in that economy. And if the poorest people are doing well, then your economy is doing well. I guess what we're talking about here is the undue influence that accumulating too much wealth can have? And what do you do to stop that? Do you stop them from accumulating the wealth? Do you just regulate the hell out of them? I've kind of got this idea. I've got this idea that, let's say, somebody can earn as much as they like, right? But they can't use it except for their own purpose. So they can't lobby politicians. They can't use it for influence. They can only use it for themselves. So they can buy a house and they can buy another house. After a while, they're going to have everything they need. Now, if they can't, you just say, look, you can have as much money as you like, but it can't be used for the public bad. It has to be. It has to fit within the public good. Well, there'd be no reason to have much money after you've got everything you need, would there?
Yeah. I have a theory which has not been tried in practice, which is basically the way to control the number of billionaires and the excesses of the very wealthy is to simply turn off the tap. Stop creating the conditions where they can accumulate such extraordinary wealth. You don't have to tax them retrospectively. Like, this might just be me, but if you look at the tech billionaires who lined up at Trump's coronation last year to see him into power,
yeah.
These are not the best and brightest that humanity has ever produced. These are people who, if you leave them to their own devices, I am reasonably confident that the idiot tax will see their wealth dwindle away pretty damn quickly. It's just that we have tilted the playing field so much in the favour of established wealth.
And there's an interesting thing which I heard the other day about wealthy people and their success. Now, you take someone like Elon Musk, and, well, before we realised that he was a complete and utter arsehole, he was credited with, you know, the electric car. That's a good thing. Smart fella. Innovative. He's doing clever things. And so you're going, well, he's a clever guy. He's doing clever things. Maybe he deserves some success. Now, remember, this is before we found out he was an arsehole. And there's a kind of like, you could say, yeah, look, there's a point to that. But what I heard the other day was that most successfully wealthy people start off wealthy. And this is important because you'll say, oh, well, Elon Musk had a good idea and he deserves to be wealthy. Elon Musk started off with a lot of money in the first place.
Yes.
So he was able to try a few things out and fail. Try this, try that. And then if you've got enough irons in the fire, one of them hopefully will take off. So the thing which makes a success for a wealthy person is not the fact that they're smart, but the fact that they're very well resourced. You know, we've seen this with Trump. Trump was has been bankrupt how many times? He ran a casino. He ran a casino bankrupt. He ran an institution which basically says,
money,
give me your
casino,
money.
Yes.
But because he came from wealth and because he was unscrupulous, he was able to succeed. Now, if you and I tried to start a venture, and I have, I've actually run my own business, and it failed during the GFC, well, that's it. I sort of go, right, well, you know, I could kick around a bit more, but that was my one business. And it came to its natural conclusion, and you just go, well, okay, I'm back on the tools again. That's normal people who don't have, you know, families and dads and who accumulated wealth and allow them to make mistakes. So the real success to being wealthy is to have enough wealth so that when you get things wrong, you can still continue and hopefully something will take off eventually. And that kind of dispels the myth that, you know, Elon Musk is really smart. Elon Musk is really rich.
yeah. I mean, he was the son of a South African diamond miner and bought an electric car company that was already up and running and took credit for its products.
Yeah, and it didn't go very well, but he had enough wealth behind him to keep going with it. You know, Trump's father was a property developer after World War II, and he...
Well, that's putting it kindly. I would call him a slumlord.
A slumlord, yes. So he got money from the government to erect accommodation for return services. So, you know, Trump tells you about, you know, private enterprise and that sort of stuff. His wealth was built off government contracts.
Yeah.
so it's kind of bizarre. We're going to have a bit of a music break. I went to see Massive Attack on Tuesday. I've known Massive Attack for quite some time. I thought they're a nice band. Didn't really think much more of it than that, other than, you know, and I was listening to some of their songs thinking, oh, maybe I'm getting a bit tired of Massive Attack, but I'll go and have a listen anyway. Went to see them, and the show was amazing. It was mind-blowingly amazing. It was essentially the band who were playing in very subdued lighting and this massive screen behind them that started off with Palantir attacking Palantir, went to Gaza, went to the Congo. You've got kids mining in the Congo. It was a full-on political assault from start to finish. There was a big cries of free Palestine going on. I didn't know anything about the how political massive attack were. Mm-hmm. And while I'm sitting there was at least like a third of the way through the show, there was a big free Palestine call from the audience. And this guy behind me goes, oh, can we just listen to some music? And I just thought, mate, you're at the wrong gig. Anyway, I'm going to play Teardrop by Massive Attack. And while this song was playing, on the screen behind them, they were showing all the stats of Gaza. They were showing all the people who were killed in Gaza, how many buildings have been destroyed in Gaza, how many hospitals have been destroyed, how many medics have been attacked, how many, just going through all the stats while this song was playing. So put yourself there and think of this.
What's taking place in Palestine is horrendous.
Here are some ways that you can keep yourself informed and involved.
Listen in to Palestine Remembered every Saturday morning at 9:30 a.m. or listen to the podcast.
Join the APAN mailing list at apan.org.au for updates, news about actions you can get involved in, and where you can donate to provide humanitarian assistance.
Listen to other news and current affairs programs on 3CR that also cover Palestine.
The oppression of the Palestinian people has been going on for 75 years. It has to stop. You can be part of making that happen by staying informed and active.
APAN is a proud supporter of 3CR.
You're with Anne and Kev on Radio MMT.
At 3CR Community Radio in Melbourne, Australia.
And wherever you get your podcasts.
Economics for the rest of us.
You're on Radio MMT with Kev and Katie today. Anne's not here today. It's Katie and Kev. We've been talking about capitalism what it's doing to the world. And what we should be doing next. I'm just going to touch on that Massive Attack song that I just played, Teardrop, which is a beautiful song. The band was really subdued. They really didn't highlight themselves. It was all about the screen behind them. And it's just their outrage. It's what's happening in Gaza. Now, we're talking about capitalism, and if you want to see the pointy end of capitalism going wrong, then what's happening over there is about as bad as it can get. We've got a genocide going on with Israel attacking its neighbour, crying that it's a victim from the past and that it has a right to do this. But it's all about oil. If there was no oil in the Middle East, there would be none of this conflict, because Israel wouldn't be supported by the US. They wouldn't be armed to the back teeth, and they wouldn't be aggressively... they wouldn't have the capability to aggressively attack their neighbours. This is... Yeah. A profit-driven war, with Israel being the Western outpost in the Middle East. It's
like, if I was being cynical, I would say that somebody in American state planning has always understood MMT, because what they're actually doing with this extraordinary amount of bloodshed and supporting authoritarian regimes and apartheid states and so on is basically in inflation management, confronting the problem of how did all our oil end up underneath your sand? they're ensuring that the oil comes to them as cheaply as humanly possible by making sure that the governments of the region are amenable to this arrangement.
Yeah, well, I think from my understanding, I could be incorrect, but when the oil started running out in Texas and the oil started running out in the North Sea, just north of the UK, so that Britain and the US, their own oil supplies started dwindling, they moved to the Middle East and invested heavily, and they're using Israel as their base to control the area, and they've tried to get everybody else on board. They can't get Iran. There's a fantastic podcast that I listen to by a fellow called Trip Loy. Trip, T-R-I-P-L-O-I. I would recommend anybody to listen to this guy. He is fantastic. And he did a deep dive on Iran for the last 500 years. And you see yet again US involvement, US interference in a region with one purpose: to get the oil, to make profit. Getting in there, interfering stuff, and you end up with the mess that we've got. Mm-hmm. But Iran has a history that goes back, well, thousands of years, but they are resilient. They've had people invading or trying to invade them for years and years and years, and they refuse to be colonized. They just won't let it happen. They were invaded by the British during World War II to set up a supply route to Russia or the USSR, as they were allies at that particular time. That ended in 1950. They had a couple of glorious years of rebuilding themselves until the Americans came back and said, 1953, we've got a better idea. How about we impose this Shah on you and steal all your oil again? It's yes. like again, no oil, there'd be none of these problems.
And this is like oddly consistent when it comes to free trade and democracy and all the things that the West claims to be in favour of. When it turns out that this doesn't suit the interests of the West, then that
they just
those considerations
down.
Go out of the window.
They just come down hard. They dress it up as this, you know, that like they're liberating something. The one that got me, this was the one that opened my eyes, was Indonesia. Have you heard of the Jakarta method before?
No, that's a new one on me.
Okay, so and why we don't know about these things is amazing to me. Again, I got this from the Trip Lloyd podcast. Indonesia, was it the Dutch? I think we're all over Indonesia. There was a reaction to the socialism of the USSR after World War One, 1917, the Russian Revolution, and that was making some headway in Indonesia, who were trying to find some form of independence, you know, everybody just piss off and we can manage ourselves. That was coming along, and there was Sukarno. There was a leader, Sukarno, who was collaborating with the socialists leading up until World War II. Then World War II happened, the Japanese came in. The Dutch were still controlling Indonesia at this stage. But anyway, the Japanese came in and kicked the Dutch out. And then they were pretty brutal themselves. They basically replaced one violent regime with another. But Sukarno thought, well, I'm just going to let this one play out, because he didn't think that the Japanese were going to win the war. And he thought, well, they've come in and they've kicked the Dutch out for us. So that's one good thing. And they're probably going to lose. So let's just see how this plays out. And it played out pretty well. Sukarno and the socialists, he wouldn't call himself a socialist, but he was like-minded. They actually succeeded, and Indonesia was independent and quite socialist up until about 1949, when the CIA came in and recruited Suharto to murder all the socialists. They murdered a million communists or socialists.
Yeah.
Just murdered them. And they said, that's how you solve this problem. You just kill them all. We won't kill them ourselves. We'll get the fellow, you know, Sukarno to do it instead. And Suharto, sorry, to do it instead, and wipe them all out. And they thought this was such a good idea. They then employed that method through Central America. You know, take your pick, Chile, Nicaragua, etc. Just if you've got a problem, just wipe them out, and problem solved.
yeah. I think Milton Friedman said that he would much rather see a liberal dictatorship than an illiberal democracy. So, you know, if you want free trade, you want to be able to negotiate with the one guy at the top instead of have to meddle about with politics and the will of the people and
people,
so on.
People with ethics and things like that. You just want to deal with somebody who is solely driven by profit, probably highly corruptible. That's a far more effective scheme of managing your profits. This is the method that is widely acclaimed to be the best method. It's led by the democratic capitalist of the United States of America, where Trump is now, well, he's been talking about this for quite some time. He would like to make it illegal to oppose capitalism. So if you are a socialist, he wants to lock you up. He thinks you should be in jail. This is the free speech, you know, the democratic capitalist way.
It is the shining light on the hill to which we should all aspire. Yeah.
Yeah.
But again, you know, it shows how flexible capitalists are to ideological change. They will quite happily negotiate with whoever it happens to be in power.
It's the way they get away with it, though, and this is where you start to uncover some of the organisations that support capitalism. I mean, like we've talked about the Mont Pelerin Society and Hayek. You've got the Chicago School of Economics. And then you start seeing all these organizations, the Atlas Organization, the IPA, the Institute of Public Affairs, the Heritage Foundation. And there's a whole range of organizations which are really well funded, not surprisingly, because the people that are funding them are billionaires and the system supports them. So you don't hear about the massacre in Indonesia. You don't hear about all of these things. They're framed in a way to say that there was an uprising which needed to be quelled and that freedom was at stake, because the propaganda and the press that's put around it is controlled and managed by these sorts of organizations, who then end up running the news corporations as well. What have you discovered in your quest looking for these mobs?
Okay, well, I have taken a bit of a rummage around the head of the heads of these people.
Yep.
One of the big MAGA think tanks in America is something called the Claremont Institute, which publishes an online magazine called The American Mind. And my goodness, if you have a bit of a rummage around the American Mind for a while, it's a very...
That's very, a dangerous place to go.
It's a very disturbing experience.
There's another one, CPAC, and I'm trying to remember what it stands for, but these are the Christian moral people. This whole confluence of Christianity and capitalism is kind of interesting. I think the logic goes that as Christians, we are God's special chosen people, and and the Jews will be saying the same thing. But now, I'm not going to conflate Zionism with Judaism. I reckon they're two completely different things. So when we're talking about... We're talking about Israel. We're talking about a political movement, not a religious movement. They will conflate the two, but to me, there's a clear difference. There's enough people of Jewish faith who are absolutely appalled by what's being
Zionism,
done in their name.
Yeah.
So there's that. But the Christians believe that they are God's chosen people, and that the world is theirs to exploit, and that they are separate from nature, and therefore nature is there for them to make them profitable. That's the logic, as far as I can see.
Yeah. And they have quite a lot of common ground with people who are formerly free marketeers but are now quite devoted status once they've realised that, you know, the state can be theirs. The one thing that the Trumpists are very, very good at is creating a coalition of people of wildly varying ultimate utopias, but they all agree on the next couple of steps. And that's all you need. You just need people who agree on the next couple of steps.
Right.
So you can have like a totally immoral person like Donald Trump being a hero to the Christian right, because they just agree on the next couple of steps. They just agree on getting rid of whatever, you know, cultural bugaboo is facing them.
Well, you can see with Trump and the Christian right that, you know, there's this whole abortion thing. So all he has to do is go, rightio, if I support their stance on abortion, it's going to be profitable, so I will do that. Ethics don't come into it, right? What confounds me is that the Christians go, right, well, good. You've now seen the light.
Yeah.
You're one of us. And you go, no, he's not. Of course he's not. He's doing what's profitable. The presidency has just been one big profit-making venture for him with his crypto coins and the rest of it.
Well, I mean, they do come up with a very coherent strategy, but it's based on this idea that we as a society are faced by this existential threat, as we have been in past times. So here's Kevin Roberts from the Heritage Foundation talking about Reagan. He says that as in the late 1970s, Americans today experience the failures of political and cultural elites in countless ways, etc., etc., etc. But in truth, he says, these daily dysfunctions are not innumerable problems, but innumerable manifestations of a few core crises. In 1979, the threats were the Soviet Union, the socialism of 70s liberals, and the predatory deviancy of cultural elites. Reagan defeated these beasts by ignoring their tentacles and striking instead at their hearts. So it's like there's this grab bag of things you don't like, and it's all part of one huge existential threat to existence as we know it. And everything you're being told that's to do with the real world, that is all part of a smokescreen. That is evidence of the corruption. You listen to someone talk about the evils of racism or climate catastrophe or whatever else, and that doesn't reflect the real world. That just proves that person is part of the enemy, part of the insidious threat.
Getting back to the very beginning of the show, we can see that capitalism is self-destructive and that it's already running past its boundaries. The resources needed for its model, which is a profit-driven model, to continue, those resources are running out. And it's going to end badly, either one way or another. And what we see is a continuation of this model of conflict, because that's the conflict of the capitalist system is more profitable than the... More profitable for who? More profitable for the elites. And the elites are calling the shots and they don't want to share. And yet exactly what we need to do is collaborate, cooperate and share to face this crisis. Let's cast forward 50 years, 100 years. Let's say the catastrophe is now so obvious that it can no longer be ignored. There's food shortages, there's mass extinction, there's people dying in large numbers. What's going to happen? Bill mentioned on the last show that you'll see Europe invading, using their might to source food from Africa, who won't be able to defend themselves. So we're just going to see stronger economies pilfering from the less able to defend themselves economies, which is what's happening now with the global north.
That's
and the global
south.
That's
been happening for the last 50 years, yeah, since... Yeah.
Or you're going to see people in the global south, those the victims of this audacious stealing of resources. Would that be enough for them to say enough? And is that when you see climate change accelerate a long overdue revolution?
I think the decision is something that has to be made in the wealthy countries. And as I say before, capitalism is a public sector project. You know, we don't have to defeat it. They are not all powerful. What they have got through our acquiescence.
Yeah, yes.
And through public policy that we have set up to benefit them.
The government gave them private markets. The government can take away private markets.
Yeah. So going back to Bill's point, we don't need to violently overthrow these people. We can reduce or eliminate capitalism by just dialing it down or switching it off based on policy settings.
We're seeing the Social Democrats on the rise in the US. Luigi Maglione, the fellow that knocked off the health insurance CEO, he was looking at terrorism charges. They've been dropped. I just noticed this morning he's probably going to go to jail for a long time, but it's all been winding back. I'm just sort of I shouldn't say this, but we need more Luigi's. We need more random picking off of elites that would. Oh no, we don't. But look, if that happened, which is like what happened with the Russian Revolution, a lot of other revolutions, where if you're out there too high, but somebody's going to knock you off because it's just wrong. So I think we've got to go. because you're running over time.
Okay.
It's been lovely having you on, Katie. We've been just rambling and talking, etc. We've got our pub night coming up. We'll be at the end of this month somewhere for the Public Money, Public Good. Mafalda is coming up next. So thank you very much for having us. It was a bit of a rambly show today, but I enjoyed it nonetheless. Catch you next time.
You've been listening to Radio MMT with Anne and Kev.
We'd love your feedback. Email us on radiommt@gmail.com or search Radio MMT on social media.
Listen to this show anytime, wherever you get your podcasts, or on 3cr.org.au/Radio MMT.
Support this show and the station by subscribing to 3cr.org.au and mention Radio MMT.
We thank all our guests.
And we thank economist Professor Bill Mitchell and his MMTED.org, educating masses on modern monetary theory.
And thank you to our listening listeners for listening. And I thank you, Kevin.
And I thank you, Anne. So what's planned for next week?
Kevin, there is still so much to talk about. We've got to expose all this rotten economics.
Well, that's good, and I get it. Do you reckon we could use a bit more music?
Well, I made a list of all these terrible economic theories. Like, I've heard of the theory of comparative advantage, or the quantity theory of money, or the loanable funds theory.
Have you heard of a band called Single Gun Theory? Like, they're a really good band. I'm sure there's a whole range of, like, macroeconomic music that I could bring into the show.
Yeah, but we really need to do marginal productivity theory, not to mention the natural rate of unemployment.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.